Welcome to this week's episode of Babelfish, the podcast where non-believers share their life stories. In this week's episode, I talk to two humanists. First, I talk to Mark. We talk about him finding Sagan and Dawkins in a bookshop in Iran. We talk about scientific method, skepticism, and sexual education. Then I talk to Hinara. We talk about Maori culture, rituals, and superstition. We talk about his online group for Maori non-believers. I would like to thank my Patreons, Happy and Lene Peterson. Thank you so much for your support. Please give Babelfish a good rating in your podcast app. Please share Babelfish with your family and friends. In order to continue the podcast, I need funding. Remember, you can support Babelfish by becoming a Patreon. Become a Patreon on patreon.com or the Danish equivalent, tenet.dk. You will find the links in the episode description. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Babelfish. I'm in New Zealand still, in Wellington again, talking to Mark. Hello and welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you. I like New Zealand.
It's a nice place, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it is. So can you present yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, my name is Mark Honeychurch. I've been involved with the skeptical and atheist movements in New Zealand for about 7 or 8 years now. At one point was the chair of the skeptics and I've been the president of the humanists as well. So I like to be involved with groups and I just like being able to help out where I can, really.
Okay, and how old are you?
Sorry. 44.
44, yeah. So, and how did you become an atheist and skeptic and humanist?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah. So I was a Christian from about the age of 17. And that lasted through until I was about 29. And in my late 20s with my wife, we were traveling through the Middle East and we ended up in Iran.
But you didn't become a Christian until you were 17.
No, yeah, so I was an atheist until
then.
I think maybe, being honest, part of the reason I became a Christian was because I met a young Christian girl that I liked, my now wife, and I think maybe her religion had something to do with my conversion. At the time, obviously, I'd swear blind, it had nothing to do with it. I converted totally of my own accord.
Yeah, exactly. So you got married and then you travelled Iran?
Yeah, so we got married and we travelled a few times. We lived in London for a few years and then we were travelling the Middle East on the way to New Zealand. And in Iran, I went into an old dusty bookshop and I picked up a couple of books that looked interesting. One of which was The Blind Watchmaker by Richard Dawkins.
Iran.
Yeah, I know. It's weird. It's like, well, why do they have this? But apparently it wasn't a forbidden book or this bookshop got away with it. So I had a read of that.
Yeah, I think books are not, they're not illegal in Iran. So I've talked to an Iranian guy about it. So those books are legal. You can buy them.
Yes, I would have thought some topics would have been just not allowed, but apparently this was okay. So I read that book and it made sense. I enjoyed it. But the other book that really fascinated me was, and this is from memory, I think the title was something like The Proceedings of the 1962 Symposium on Extraterrestrial Communications. What it was, it was a fascinating book. Yeah. So it was a bunch of essays and they came from a meeting that scientists had from around the world, just trying to look at the topic of talking with aliens. Are they out there? Can we talk to them? And so it had, I think, an article by Carl Sagan, young Carl Sagan then, I guess, at the time. By Frank Drake, so just introducing the Drake equation, trying to figure out, you know, how many alien species are out there, what can we expect? So it was really fascinating. And what I did was I looked at it and I said, this is a topic, talking with aliens, that's just crazy. It's silly, it's far-fetched. You know, there are probably aliens out there, but the idea of talking with them, it's something where you can imagine there being a lot of nonsense. But what these scientists did was that they went, no, we can be scientific about this. Yes. We can focus on it. We can bring to bear our best minds. We can be logical. We can come up with experiments. We can think about what is the likelihood of this,
yeah,
how are they going to communicate? You know, is it going to be lasers? Is it going to be radio frequencies? If it's a radio frequency, what frequencies would they use? And they looked at things like the hyperfine transition as of hydrogen as being a common frequency that would work well throughout the universe, and everybody would know about it. So they really were as logical as they could be about a topic that it was hard to be logical about. And I contrasted that with my religion. And with my religion, it's the same kind of thing. It's this crazy idea that there's an all-knowing God out there that's looking down on us, and he's got all these rules. And I thought, okay, so what are the religious people that I look up to doing about this? Are they being honest? Are they being logical and rigorous? Are they putting in their best efforts in order to try and dissect what's true and what's not? And the answer was obviously that they weren't. That, you know, in total juxtaposition to this book, these guys were just all saying, you have to trust me. This is what I've divined. Here's something that, you know, I spent years thinking about and I think is right. But nobody was inventing tests. No. Nobody was thinking of ways of falsifying these ideas. And so that
falsifying clash, is very important.
That clash between the two, it was just like, no, well, you know, I like how these scientists are treating this. I don't like how the religious leaders that I look up to are treating my religion. And coupled with that, the other thing that I saw in Iran was that the people of Iran, the Muslims that I was meeting, they were so kind and so generous. And again, this just clashed with my own religion. The Christians that I knew and myself, we were not people who were being as generous, as kind, as loving as the Muslims as I met in Iran. And I thought, well, if my religion is the right one, how come the people I know who believe this are just acting horribly or not as nicely as these people who have a different religious belief? And obviously one option there would be to become a Muslim, to start believing in Islam, but it just seemed like, well, am I just swapping? Would I be swapping one silly religious belief for another? And I figured maybe this points out that none of them really have the truth. You know, none of them actually stand up above the rest. There is no religion that stands out as, wow, you know, these people are fitter, healthier, more productive. Nobody seems to have the edge. Their God isn't helping them in a way that makes it obvious. So I was like, well, I don't believe in any religion. And so I privately became atheist. I think it was in the Rose Garden in Esfahan in Iran. And I spent several months building up the courage to tell my wife that I'd become atheist, because we'd married as Christians, and it was going to be a whole letting her down to tell her that I'd changed, because, you know, this was a covenant we had and I was going to break it. So that was a hard thing to do.
That's understandable.
But we got there, and we're still together, and we have three kids now. So
is she still a Christian?
No.
Okay.
But she doesn't really like to talk about it.
Okay.
We spent many years on opposite sides of this.
And
at first I was, I guess, obnoxious. I think a lot of atheists, when they first become atheists,
they're really annoying.
Quite strident, looking for arguments. And that was me. But a lot of that was directed at my wife. From my perspective, I wanted to make sure I'd made the right decision. I wanted to make sure that she didn't think that I'd done something stupid. And so I was kind of arguing my case, like, in defense of my decision. But for her, it must have been awful. It must have been this onslaught of me questioning her religious beliefs.
All the time,
And I think religious beliefs generally don't stand up to questioning very well. So it's hard when people are around someone that's going to question them, when they when you just can't get away from that questioning. It must be pretty horrible. In fact, I was in the pub this afternoon with a Muslim I work with talking about religion, and I halfway through the conversation I kind of felt sorry for him that in me he's got someone who's kind of a confident, outspoken atheist having a chat with him in the pub, and he's just come into his religion properly recently. You know, he's at university. He's met with a senior cleric who's looking after him and walking him through Quranic study sessions, and so he's becoming a more devout Muslim as time goes on. And I'm just kind of sitting there opposite him saying, no, it's all nonsense. I don't believe it. In a polite way, obviously.
Okay, but you're still together, so that's good. You and your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been ups and
downs.
You
managed. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, essentially, you know, we do get on, I think, quite well as people. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, we've weathered it, and now it's just the case that I think she's moved away from the church, and I don't think she has any interest in activism, any interest in kind of helping out with humanism or anything like that. But I think she's realised that a lot of what I've said about religion and how it doesn't make sense, I think she's come to accept that.
Oh, okay.
And she's come to realise that actually religion wasn't giving her anything except for a false hope.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think here's an interesting one. A part of that was when we had children, I think that made quite a difference.
Yeah.
And I think she started thinking not so much about me, but about our children and what was going to happen to them. Because she realized that our children weren't necessarily going to be Christians. So they started off as Christians. I was fine with my wife taking them to church. But over time, they started asking questions. And I wasn't going to back down from telling them what I believe being honest about my side of it.
Yeah.
And my wife looked at that and realized that if the children stopped being religious, as far as her religion was concerned, they were going to hell.
Yeah.
And she didn't like that idea.
No.
So the first place she went was she tried to find a type of Christianity that fit well with that. So she ended up with Rob Bell. So Rob Bell came out with an idea a few years ago. He's an American pastor.
Yeah.
And he came out with the idea that maybe there is no hell. Maybe when you die, if you're not a Christian, hell isn't real. And instead, God gives you infinite chances to believe in him. Mm. And eventually you will. You can keep going around in circles and eventually you'll have to accept Jesus into your heart.
Yeah.
And at that point you go into heaven. So you might just go through a few thousand cycles before you get
reincarnation,
there.
Reincarnation, included. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was all within heaven and just constantly being asked that question. So Rob's idea, and a lot of Christians don't like it, but it's there's no hell. Mm. We all go to heaven eventually. It just, for some people, it might take a while. And so she started to believe that because then her children were not going to hell. And that was easier for her.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, even then that wasn't enough, that it still didn't sit right with her. Especially, I think, after my eldest did come out and say she started thinking that God was silly. God didn't make any sense, and isn't it creepy that there's this guy up in the sky
watching you?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I think she must have, because I'm honest with my children about what I think about God, but I've never said things like that. So I think maybe it's from school friends that kind of thing has come from.
Yeah.
Or maybe she's just thought about them herself and these are the conclusions she's come to. But it's kind of it's nice to see her trying to think about it.
Yeah. And think about it for herself. Yeah, that's nice. Okay. And how did you become active?
So I think 2012, 2013. So by that point, I'd spent a few years on the internet.
Yeah.
Reading and to an extent engaging with the atheist crowd.
Okay.
And I think...
Before we come to that, have you faced any challenge? Besides within your marriage, there's been some challenges. What about elsewhere?
No, I don't think so. I think, I mean, New Zealand's a fairly progressive country.
Yeah.
I mean, there are issues with religion in this country, but I've never felt threatened or in danger. My side of the family is not very religious, so that's never been a problem. My wife's side is, and we've had some fun, heated arguments, but nothing that's been a major problem. It's good-hearted, and we're all friends at the end.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you spent a few years online searching.
Yeah, so atheism was, I guess, where it started. But from there online, I learned about the broader ideas of skepticism.
Yeah.
And I learned about being skeptical, not just about religion, but spreading that wider to everything. And after that, I started realizing that within this wide range of bad beliefs that people have, some of them were very dangerous. And I think religion is one of the dangerous ones. It is one of the ones that tends to damage people in lots of different ways. I mean, the bad beliefs that they have, ideas of being healed by faith and by prayer, the money that religion takes from people, I think it's all fairly damaging. But then looking across to things like alternative medicine, they were also really damaging. And taking people's money and giving them false hope and putting that veneer of science over it, that that bullshit layer that made people think that this is true and conned them into believing. And I hated that. And so I felt like from that, it wasn't enough to be sitting on my couch, that I needed to go out and talk to people and see what other people were doing about it. You know, who was actually out there trying to stop this tidal wave of nonsense? And so I went out to a Skeptics in the Pub meeting. And almost got scared away the first time. I think
it was too much.
Skeptics are weird people, right? We are an odd bunch, and I think for a lot of people that turn up to these groups, it's quite an adventure to go out there, and it can be quite scary. And the people at Skeptics groups can be odd; they can be opinionated. I think I was just hit by a wall of, whoa, what is this? What's going on?
Okay.
But I persevered, and I carried on turning up every other week to the Wellington Skeptics in the Pub here in New Zealand and started making some really good friends. And pretty quickly, I was asking about activism. What were people doing? You know, who was tackling alternative medicine in New Zealand? And it turned out that nobody was, really. The Skeptic Society was kind of doing it, but not really in a big way. And so fairly quickly, I organized a second Skeptics in the Pub meeting, which was skeptical activism. And so we meet in the pub, and we have done for about 6 years now. And we just sit there at a table in a pub with laptops and we complain. And we are really good at complaining. We we find people claiming to cure cancer, leukemia, hemorrhoids, whatever it is. If they've got this alternative treatment and they make medical claims, we chop them into whoever we can. So that might be in this country, MedSafe, which is a government department, or the Commerce Commission. It might be the Advertising Standards Authority or Broadcasting Standards.
Okay.
But we know there are existing laws in this country.
It's a workathon, actually. Basically, you're there, you meet up, you work.
We work and we drink beers.
Yeah.
So it's the best of both worlds. And we try and make sure that we get in at least one complaint every time we meet, each of us. And we just keep slogging away at it in the hope that eventually people will get the message that the law says you can't make these silly claims. And if you do, we're going to report you to the law and try and get you told off. But it really is an uphill battle, and there is a lot of it out there.
There is so much out there.
So it was about 6 months of running this group when I heard about the humanists. And I was interested in humanism. It's like, well, this sounds like it fits me well. I'm an atheist, and you know, I'm interested in living a good life. And so I came along to the humanist meetings in Wellington, and they had monthly meetings with a speaker. The speakers were interesting and varied. The people were really welcoming, mainly older people. The age was definitely
quite old.
It's something that would be nice to fix. I mean, I'm getting old now. But I guess when I first started, I was still in my 30s, which I had going for me.
You're really young then, compared to all the others.
So I think myself, and at the time we had an Irish guy over here called Cormac. He committed to coming along every month as well. We really wanted to bring the average age down. And we wanted to make it a little bit more welcoming for younger people. And it is always a struggle to make sure that you are welcoming. It's hard to always be happy and joyous when someone walks through the door and proactive in asking who they are. But, you know, it has to be done. And we need to make sure we're not scaring people away. So through the humanists, I've done little bits and bobs of activism. So I work on help with the Secular Education Network. So we've got a problem over here at the moment that part of our... So the main thrust of our education law for primary school students, so from 5 years on, our law says that education must be of a secular nature. Which is great. Having secular education is exactly what we want. But through a whole series of things that the church did back in the day, what was added to the law was the idea that a church, a school, could close for half an hour, let's say in the middle of the day, and while the school or even just one classroom in the school was closed, that classroom could be used for religious instruction.
Mm-hmm.
And a religious leader could come into the school, they could teach Jesus as fact, they could walk kids through what it means to believe in Jesus and why their friends are going to hell. And all this is okay. And it can all happen, as far as the kids are concerned, as a school lesson. They don't see it as being something outside of school, because it's during school time. Sometimes it's even the school teacher that can run the sessions. So that's horrible. And it's got to go. And we're hoping it will go. But at the moment, there is a court case that a couple of people are taking the government to court in this country.
Okay.
And that's really nice. They're very brave doing it, much braver than I am.
Yeah.
But me being a little bit gobby and happy to chat, I'm one of the two spokespeople for this. So whenever it ends up in the news, I get to talk on the radio.
So when do you think the court case will be?
So the court case, I think, is slated for the end of this year, so October, November. We've had an interesting twist in the last few weeks, which is that the education secretary has said that he's going to make a slight change in law so that the lessons now will have to be opt-in. So at the moment, they can be run as opt-out, where kids have to go unless their parents sign a form saying otherwise.
If the parents are told that it's gone.
And often the parents aren't told. Often the parents aren't even told that it's a religious course. They might be told it's just values and ethics or something like that.
So
the churches can be really underhanded. I mean, they're supposed to be the better people.
Yeah.
And so often they're very underhanded in how they get to children and get to teach children that Jesus is the only true way. It's creepy to see
it.
So
he will change it slightly to opt in.
Yeah, so he's going to change it to opt in, and it's not enough. For the Secular Education Network, it's not enough. It's got to go. I think practically it is going to make a dent. I think that what we've seen so far in this country, when a school has gone from opt-out to opt-in, quite often the attendance drops enough that the church looks at it and says it's not worth running the classes anymore.
Okay.
So we're I think, quietly hoping that it will make a difference.
Yes.
But even then, we know there'll probably be a few hundred schools that hold on for dear life and just refuse to get rid of religious instruction. So, it looks like the court case has still got to go ahead. It would be really nice to see that change done properly. And to see the schools return to how they were always envisioned in this country, which is being secular. And then outside of that, secondary schools don't have these laws, so you can have religious instruction in secondary schools. That will be another fight. And then religious observances, so religious assemblies and other events like that, they're a different case altogether. So,
and it's allowed in all schools?
Yeah, so I think the new law they're looking at bringing in this year, again, will limit the number of religious observances that happen. I think they'll be lumped in with religious instruction, and it'll be no more than 20 hours a year for both,
The
looks of things. But we'll see.
20 hours is a lot.
It is, yeah. It's about something like half an hour a week over the whole school year.
That's
and,
a lot.
And some schools, I believe, in the past have gone over that and accidentally given too much religious instruction in a year. You know, all these things that happen accidentally. There are lots of stories over here that kids who accidentally get included in the classes even when they've been opted out. We've had kids that have been given jobs to do. So obviously the kids that are opted out, they have to be looked after by the school. They've been given jobs like going up and down the school playing field and picking up rubbish, or cleaning the dishes in the staff room for all the teachers.
They should have a relevant class.
Absolutely. They should have a non-religious equivalent class that runs at the same time.
Yeah.
But schools have never needed to do that. A lot of them think, why should they be bothered? That's extra
When
effort.
I went to school and everybody else went to classes before their confirmation, I just slept in late.
Wouldn't that be nice?
So that would be a possibility, but it requires then that it's early in the morning or late in the afternoon, and then
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think probably the best place, if it's in school at all, the best place would be as an after-school club.
Yes.
Just like all the other after-school clubs.
Exactly.
But I'm not even sure that's a good thing, because it's still using the school premises, and that still gives a legitimacy to these religious instruction classes that I don't think they deserve. They haven't earned it.
No.
And these places, they have their own establishments. They have their own buildings where they already teach this to children.
They have plenty of space to do it on their own.
It seems a little bit odd that they're trying to get into schools as well and arguing that it's their right when they've already got so much help from the government for the churches that they run tax-free.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, they've had a free ride, a good ride for so long.
yeah. But good luck with changing the laws.
Yeah, it's a big one. I really hope it works out for us. and certainly, you know, doing my little bit for it is it's nice to be able to help in some way.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, as I said, these guys, Tanya and David, who are actually taking the government to court, my goodness, they are bold.
Brave. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I hope, I'll keep up on the news from New Zealand by the end of the year. It's going to be interesting.
Keep an eye out. We might be having a big party.
Yeah, you will. Okay, but thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
It was great talking and meeting you.
This was my talk with Mark. Coming up is my talk with Henare.
I'm talking to, how do you pronounce your name?
Henare.
Henare, yeah. Hello and welcome. Maybe you can present yourself to the listeners.
Okay, kia ora. Hello. My name's Henare. I'm originally from the Eastern Bay of Plenty area, but I've lived here in Wellington for 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm. And how old are you?
So how old am I? I'm 30-ish.
Yeah, 30-ish.
I'm 37 at the moment.
Okay, yeah. And how did you become a non-believer, a humanist?
So we weren't brought up strictly religious or anything. Although I was christened in the Anglican Church as a child, and we grew up with a belief in God. It wasn't very strong, but it was always there. But I tell people that when I moved here as a 15-year-old, I was away from my culture, so it forced me to become a little bit stronger in my culture. And part of that was I held on a little bit tighter to my Māori beliefs.
Yeah, because your Māori religion. Background. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that led me to sort of start questioning or rejecting this idea of this white God
Christian
from
God.
The Bible.
Yeah.
Yes. So that sort of started the whole thing. And so once that process happened and I was able to let go of the God of the Bible, over the years that just developed into me questioning our Māori gods.
Yeah. It's a multi... it has several gods in Māori culture.
Yeah. So it's probably be polytheist. So we have gods of different elements, like the god of the ocean and the winds and the weather elements and cultivated foods and a god for everything.
Yeah.
So over the years I let go of those too. Just by applying the same sort of skepticism and critical thinking that I did to this god of the Bible.
Yeah.
But also Māori culture has a lot of superstitions and supernatural beliefs, and over the years I kept questioning those, applying critical thinking to all those things, put my personal feelings aside and what I wanted to be true. So now I'm in a position where I don't believe in any gods, not because I want to necessarily, but because there's no evidence for it.
Okay, and so it was a difficult process?
It wasn't difficult in the same way that it would be difficult for a person growing up in a strictly religious country. It was awkward at times and a little bit uncomfortable. So you have debates with family a lot. People look at you sideways and think you're a bit weird. You're a little bit of an outcast.
Okay. But you're not excluded.
Not really. No.
No. Okay.
No.
Yeah.
You're not actively excluded from anything.
No, okay.
But then, because Māori pray or recite karakia, and say prayers a lot at functions, so, you know, when these things happen, you sort of cross your fingers, look out the window.
Think of something else.
Or sometimes you even play along.
Yeah.
You know, just to... yeah, so that's where I am today. I don't I don't have any supernatural beliefs at all.
Yeah. Have you faced any challenges besides people think you're weird?
I think we're pretty lucky in this country that I think half the country doesn't believe in God anyway.
Yeah.
And so it's not there's not strong pressures to have a religion. Challenges for me, the community I come from is 90% Māori.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't believe in God or go to church, they do have a lot of supernatural beliefs.
Okay.
And it just makes it a little bit tricky being in that environment where so many people still have those beliefs that you've let go of.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably been the most challenging thing.
Okay.
I guess also being a part of, so we have a thing in New Zealand called Kapa Haka, which is Māori Performing Arts.
Yeah.
And it's quite a big deal on the Māori calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And so every 2 years there's a national festival
where
groups from different tribes all around the country and Australia, they come together to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And there ends up being about 40 plus groups that compete at this competition.
Wow.
And so I go home to where I come from to perform for my group, my tribe.
Yeah.
And my tribe happens to be quite strong in the Ringatu religion, Ringatu faith, which is a hybrid religion, which is a mixture between traditional Māori practices and beliefs and Christianity.
Okay, so it's a mix. Yeah.
And it was formed around, I'd say, mid 1800s to late 1800s.
Yeah.
It's been around for a while, and a lot of our people are quite strong in this faith.
Mm.
And so when we perform, a lot of our compositions are involved with this, you know, these beliefs. And so that's where, for me, the performer comes in, because you know, some of these are songs of devotion to, to the church leaders and all this sort
of
stuff.
So they're kind of religious.
Very religious. And so
yeah.
I just sort of have to shut that part of
Of course. Yeah.
But again, it's performing. It's performing arts. So that's all part of it for me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
a bit noisy. Yeah, we'll just wait. Until the door is closed. Yeah. Okay, so it's part of the performing arts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, again, that's, you know, that's a bit challenging, but it's it's not anything that really, how would you say? You know, I'm still pretty lucky that I'm not being threatened with my life for having my beliefs and stuff.
Yeah.
That tends to be the extent of it.
Yeah, okay.
For other Māori, it is more challenging than that because they were brought up religious.
Okay. Let's go, dude.
Yeah. So they might face challenges of exclusion or what?
Yeah. So there is...
Is it Christian Māoris or also the superstitious part of...
Mainly Māori? The ones that have been brought up in Christian Māori religions.
Yeah.
For them to leave would be pretty tough.
Okay.
A lot tougher than it was for me.
Yeah.
Because they attend church regularly. You know, their whole family is quite devout.
Yes.
Whether that's Māori Mormons or Māori Catholics, or, you know.
Do you think it's more difficult for Māoris to be open about being non-believers than non-Māoris in New Zealand?
Yeah, in general, I think it is.
yeah.
Because even if they haven't been brought up in a church, most Māori will have some kind of supernatural belief, whether that's believing in spirits, afterlife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Maori culture is tightly intertwined with a lot of supernatural beliefs.
Yeah.
So to give those up, you know, most Pākehā won't, most Europeans, New Zealanders won't have that challenge.
No. Oh, okay.
So while we can give up this religion, underneath there's still a lot of superstitious beliefs. Yeah.
That you have to get rid of as well.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, and how are you involved in the humanist movement?
Well, I started my own online group called, we're a group called Māori Atheists and Freethinkers.
Okay. So it's been separate from the humanist organization?
Yeah. And I started this group basically just to try and find like-minded Māori.
Yeah.
Who gave up religion and gave up supernatural beliefs like I did.
Yeah.
Because there weren't many.
No.
And so through creating that group, I found other groups and I found the humanist group. And I've been to a couple of their meetings and the conference last year. And so that's how I ended up meeting up with humanists and the humanist group.
Yeah, but you still have a group for Māoris.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have... we call it Atua Kore, which translates probably as close as we can get it to atheist.
Yeah.
So we're godless is the literal translation.
And what do you do?
So it's basically an online forum.
Okay.
It's quite a small group, and it's a place for Māori atheists to come together and talk about their experiences and things. And what we're trying to do this year in 2020 is have a conference where we can come together and, I guess, find more of a purpose for a group.
Yeah.
I mean, we can come together and talk about how we don't believe in God. You know,
yeah.
Till the cows come home.
Yeah.
But it's not really achieving anything.
No, you need to have a forward, or you need to have a goal of some sort, a purpose. Yeah.
So we're just trying to work out what that is. And my hunch is it's got something to do with promoting values like skepticism and critical thinking and reason in our community.
Yeah.
Because while a lot of us are able to give up the God of the Bible, for example, some of us still hold on to a lot of these supernatural beliefs and we don't exercise skepticism. So I think it makes us susceptible to a lot of a lot of charlatans and bogus science and anti-vax movement and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I find it very interesting because, as I understood it, your school system is secular, but you're not necessarily taught skepticism and critical thinking.
No, I don't think not as strongly as I think it should be.
Yeah, okay.
I don't think critical thinking and skepticism is valued highly enough in this country.
Okay.
And I think it's getting a little bit worse.
Oh yeah.
And I wonder, I don't know why that is, but I've thought about it, and I think maybe we're quite lucky in this country, and our privilege is also, it's a blessing and a curse, because we get comfortable, we get complacent about a lot of things.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's got something to do with it, that there hasn't been, any pressure to really teach critical thinking and stuff.
Yeah, it hasn't been necessary, but it might, with the rise of, anti-waxers, flat earthers, and there's a lot of things coming up and growing. Yeah.
Social media and we need to learn as a society, especially Māori, to with all this information out there, to learn how to analyze it properly.
Yeah. Okay. So you will be meeting up and trying to debate what purpose you should continue.
Yes, and I think there's got to be something around that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then might be other purposes for the group too. I think there will be.
Yeah.
I think there's a need for this group.
For the group. Yeah. Okay. And what about the humanist organization? Are you involved in any activities there?
We communicate. I communicate with some of the members. We keep in touch with. Just with Gaylene, she's talking about getting involved in prisons, perhaps.
Yeah.
And helping those prisoners who want to change their lives but aren't necessarily interested in going the the religious route to
do that.
Yeah,
they don't want to talk to a priest.
Yeah, sounds like that could be somewhere we could come together too.
Oh, okay. Sounds interesting. But thank you very much. It was nice getting a more perspective as well, besides the ones I've already talked to here in New Zealand.
All right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. In order to continue the podcast, I need funding. Remember, you can support Babelfish by becoming a Patreon. You can also follow Babelfish on Facebook and Instagram. You'll find the links in the episode description. Until next time, be a happy human.